And now we continue behind the beautiful forevers, Catherine Boo's acclaimed tale of life, death and hope in the slums of Mumbai. Today, teacher and slumlord Asha has set her sights on a place in the Overcity, and those at the very bottom of the slum hierarchy are fighting for their lives.
Asha wanted to be a politician, not a low-paid kindergarten teacher. To achieve this goal, she thought she'd have to shed her slum ways, as she'd shed her village ones. It was a second kind of migration, of class. The key, she told her daughter Manju, was to study the first-class people. You see how they're living, how they walk, what they do. And then you do the same. And don't be afraid to talk to the first-class people directly. Inquire of them how to look better. Take their advice. Manju brought information home from college. Dangling earrings, low class. Tiny hoops, high class. High class women also wear jeans, she told her mother, who subsequently sanctioned a pair of bell bottoms. Asha believed a person seeking betterment should try as many schemes as possible. Manju's first idea had been to sell insurance. The Life Insurance Corporation of India was offering free training to aspiring agents. Selling such policies would put Manju in touch with affluent people while bringing more money to the household. The children in Manju's hut school came early to support her as she learned the English names of the policies. Future Confidence 2, Wealth Confident, Aspire Life. Manju practiced her pitches and rebuttals until she was fluent and passed the final exam with high marks. Then, nothing. Who did she know who could afford to buy insurance? Everybody wants their profit, she told the children, shaking her head. Next spring, if she passed her state board exams, she'd have a BA degree. With another year of study, she'd be a qualified teacher. She had no hope of securing a permanent job at a government school, since such jobs typically required paying enormous bribes to education officials. Small private schools were a likelier bet, although most of them paid so little that one girl intended to work at a call centre upon graduation. One afternoon, the children were mastering the English words chariot, knee, mirror, fish and hand. And what do you do with these hands of yours? Manju wanted to know. Eat, wash clothes, fill water. Raise them to show somebody I'm going to beat him up. Heads turned. Asha was in the doorway, enraged. How urgent is this teaching? She shouted at Manju. What is more important, these children or keeping this house in order for me? Dirty children were sprawled on the floor. Notebooks were scattered about. It was a scene unbefitting the home of an almost slumlord, an aspiring elected official. After that, Manju began teaching her class every other day, or every third day. The children understood that the choice was not her own. When a new school opened in the Pink Temple by the sewage lake, many of them gravitated to it. But it closed as soon as the leader of the non-profit had taken enough photos of children studying to secure the government funds. Late July brought a series of deaths to the slum. An old man, a scavenger, was hit by a car. A disabled man was found dead on an access road to the terminal. A body was found decomposing on the far side of the sewage lake. Annawadian suspected that Fatima had left a curse and that the whole place was now ruined, rotten, barbad. There were rumours that Annawadi and the other airport slums would be demolished after parliamentary elections next year. Sunil was spooked by the deaths and the rumours, but of more immediate concern was the fact that his younger sister had grown another inch, increasing the height gap between them. In the monsoon, there wasn't nearly enough airport garbage to feed himself and get him growing. Kalu, the garbage thief, looked out for Sunil when he was around, though Kalu was pretty small himself. Late in the afternoon, he sometimes joined Sunil on a warm pile of rubble at the far side of the sewage lake, where the slant of light before dusk made the shadows of both boys gigantic. The two boys liked studying Annawadi from a hidden vantage across the water. From the rocks, They could see how crazy lopsided all the huts were against the straight lines of the Hyatt and Meridian hotels that rose up behind them. It was as if the huts had fallen out of the sky and gotten smooshed upon landing. Kalu's expertise was in the recycling bins inside airline catering compounds. Private waste collectors emptied these dumpsters on a regular basis, but Kalu had mastered the trash truck's schedules. The night before pickup, Kalu would climb over the barbed wire fences and raid the overflowing bins. Kalu's routine had become known by the local police, however, and some constables propose that he could keep his metal scrap if he'd pass on information about local drug dealers. Kalu was equally as afraid of the police as he was of the white-suited cocaine dealers. Getting out of Mumbai was the safer bet, and his estranged father had offered him a plausible escape at a construction project 2 hours away from Annawadi. Sunil wished Kalu didn't have to go. Annawadi would lose a lot of its colour without him. It would lose the dramatic, hip-propelled enactments of Om Shanti Om and the subtler entertainment of Kalu's hair, which changed in accordance with his favourite movies. Recently, he'd grown it long and lank, like the crazy college boy played by Salman Khan in that old film, Tere Naam. Moreover, thieves like Kalu had status that garbage pickers lacked, and with Kalu's departure, Sunil would be more firmly fixed in his own identity as a scavenger. A few days before leaving, Kalu told Sunil, "My real name is Deepak Rai, don't tell anyone. Also, my main god is Ganapati." He thought Ganapati, the elephant god, the remover of obstacles, should be Sunil's main god too. Kalu returned from the construction site in mid-September as Mumbai was in the midst of the giddy festival in honour of his beloved Ganapati. The next day, Kalu scavenged for trash at the airport with Sunil. In the evening, after selling the trash to Abdul, who had been released from the detention facility pending his trial, they lingered outside the game shed. The three boys ranged across the usual subjects, food, movies, girls, the price of waste, until they headed home to sleep. Kalu had no home to retreat to. He decided to go to the airport, taking off across the thoroughfare towards the bright blue signs that lead the way to the international terminal. Arrivals, down. Departures, up. Happy journey. The following morning, Kalu lay outside Air India's red and white gates, a shirtless corpse with a grown-out Salman Khan haircut, crumpled behind a flowering hedge. A hulking mustachioed constable named Nagare rode his motorcycle into Annawadi and braked hard in front of Zerunissa. He wanted to know the whereabouts of Kalu's relatives. "Why?" "Boy's dead," he said, and he sped away. The next thing she heard was the sound of Abdul breaking down. For weeks, her eldest son had tried to forget what had happened to him in the police cell. Now, in an instant, something sealed inside him had split open. He couldn't remember the mechanics of breathing and began to speak in a clipped, frantic tone. "Kalu, his only sort of friend, dead. So now he would be arrested for the murder. The police would trap him just as Fatima had done. Kalu got murdered, eyes poked out." Other boys, less traumatized by life, had run to see the body, and their reports now flew through the slum lanes. Sunil refused to believe them, needed to see for himself. He took off, dodging the cars on Airport Road. When he finally arrived at the garden, the police were keeping everyone away. Sunil watched from a distance as Kalu's half-naked corpse was loaded into a police van. He watched the van drive away. Sunil turned and walked home, past the immense pilings of the elevated expressway being constructed in the middle of Airport Road, past a line of signs that said, "We care, we care, we care." past the long wall advertising floor tiles that stay beautiful forever. Who had done such a thing to his friend? To Annawadi boys, Kalu had been a star. To the authorities of the Overcity, he was a nuisance case to be dispensed with. Officially, the local police precinct was among the safest places in Greater Mumbai. In 2 years, only 2 murders had been recorded. "All murders we detect, 100% success," was how the senior inspector put it. But perhaps there was a trick to this success. "Succumbed to an irrecoverable illness," was the swift conclusion of the inspector in charge of Kalu's case. 15-year-old Deepak Rai, known as Kalu, had died of tuberculosis. But active, fence-climbing boys don't suddenly drop dead of tuberculosis. One thing Annawadians know as well as pathologists is that TB deaths are torturously slow. But the evidence of Kalu's body was swiftly turned to ash in a pyre at the Parsiwada crematorium, the false cause of death duly noted in an official register that had been burned through the middle by a resting cigarette. Photos of the boy's corpse, taken in accordance with police regulations, vanished from the files at the station. Investigating Kalu's death was not a profit-generating enterprise. Afterwards, 5 road boys were picked up and taken to the police station's unofficial cell. They were beaten and released with the understanding that if they didn't stay away from the increasingly elegant airport, they might find themselves charged with Kalu's murder. The boys didn't know that the police had already filed away the case as a natural death. One of the released boys, Sanjay, fled to his family's hut at Dhervi, the largest slum in the city, 5 miles south. When Sanjay reached Dhervi, his 14-year-old sister Anandi was making tomato chutney. She nearly dropped the bowl when she saw the fear in his face. Sanjay took his sister's hand and told her of seeing a group of men swarm Kalu all at once. "They killed my friend," he kept repeating. Anandi was sorry that this Kalu had been murdered. She turned back to the stove. Sanjay stretched on the floor and closed his eyes. When his mother returned, his sister was hysterical and he was convulsing on the floor. Pulling Sanjay up, thinking that he was having a seizure, his mother caught a chemical reek on his breath. His sister retrieved a white plastic bottle from the corner of the room. He had poisoned himself. Sanjay rolled over to face the wall, refusing the salt water his mother prepared to force him to vomit. He lived for 2 hours after reaching the hospital. The police inquiry into her son's death was closed as swiftly as the inquiry into Kalu's death had been. In the public record, Sanjay would be neither a vulnerable witness to a murder nor the victim of police threats and beatings. He would be a heroin addict who had decided to kill himself because he couldn't afford his next fix. Trying to make sense of the deaths of Kalu and Sanjay, Sunil and Abdul grew closer. When they spoke, it was with the curious formality of people who shared the understanding that much of what was said did not matter, and much of what mattered could not be said.
Tomorrow, the slum itself comes under threat. Asuda Bouchard reads the final installment of Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Justine Willett.
Hello, my name is Stephen Fry, and I really can't believe that I'm here in the hallowed halls, revered bowels, choose cliche of choice, of BBC Broadcasting House in London. Radio comedy is stitched deep into me. It's part of the way I speak, it's part of the way I think, it's part of the way I react, and it's certainly a full part of my writing style and comedy style. Owes everything to years and years of really starting sitting under my mother's chair when she wrote or read, listening to the tones of funny people. It was something that was just absolutely part of my life.
Any work today, or is everything back to normal? It was a very important job, one. Yes. Top secret for the Ministry of Defence.
Ah, yes, yes, I remember that. Yes, costing all their projects for next year. You hang on to it for a few more days, too, and cover it all over with figures. You know, relatives' birthdays, anything you can think of. Then just send it back to the Ministry of Defence.
Above all, I loved the silly, charming, bumbling, what would now seem rather gentle satire of programmes like Men from the Ministry.
Time to meet the Men from the Ministry.
Just hearing that from Indians, I can actually smell that particular smell that goes with a mullard tube on an old-fashioned wireless set as it's warmed up. It's a very particular thing that my generation and older will remember.
Hello, 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 hello. Fred Fiddler's the name, and furniture's my game. At your service, one and all, my card.
Oh, thank you. Fred Fiddler Limited, Shepherd's Bush. I buy old junk and sell valuable antiques.
So catch up with me, Stephen Fry, your comedy controller, online now at the Radio 4 Extra website.